Hey, good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thank you very much for tuning in. We will be in San Francisco tomorrow night doing the program, and then we're off Friday. So tonight's show may be a little bit abbreviated. We'll let you know as the evening progresses. I don't know how to do this first story other than just do it straight, so to speak. Researchers say they have located the world's oldest stash of marijuana in a tomb in a remote part of China. This cache of cannabis is about 2,700 years old, and according to a research paper in the Journal of Experimental Botany, it was cultivated for psychoactive purposes, not for fiber, not for clothing, not for food, but to get high. 2,700 years old. 789 grams. Damn, that's almost 2 pounds, isn't it? Of dried cannabis was buried alongside a light-haired, blue-eyed Caucasian male, likely a shaman of the Guxi culture near Turpan in northwestern China. According to the scientists, the extreme dry conditions and alkaline soil acted as preservatives, allowing a team of scientists to carefully analyze the stash, which still looked green. Should I go ahead? Okay. Though it had lost its distinctive odor, remnants of cannabis have been found in ancient Egypt and other sites, and the substance has been referred to by authors such as the Greek historian Herodotus. But the tomb stash is the oldest so far that could be thoroughly tested for its properties. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. The 18 researchers, most of them based in China, subjected the cannabis to a battery of tests, including carbon dating and genetic analysis. I know what you're thinking. The marijuana was found to have a relatively high content of THC, but the sample was too old to determine a precise percentage. The large cache was contained in a leather basket and in a wooden bowl and was likely meant to be used by the shaman in the afterlife. It was common practice in burials to provide materials needed for the afterlife. And then it concludes by saying the region of China where the tomb is located, Xinjiang, is considered an original source of many cannabis strains worldwide. Well, how about that? After all that nasty stuff I said about China last night, and now it turns out that they are the fountainhead of cannabis. 789 grams. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. 789 grams of reefer. 2,700 years old. You see, this is why I think that, marijuana should be what it is, just a plant that, China. There's a display here at the High Museum of Art, the terracotta soldiers from China, some of them. The display is here in Atlanta. Oh! 2,700-year-old cannabis. And the researchers say it was cultivated for psychoactive purposes rather than... Wait a minute, I just said that. Rather than as fiber for clothing or food. It was common practice in burials to provide materials needed for the afterlife. Well, 789 grams. Okay. Oh, no, not one of these. Let me see here. The chief financial officer of Cincinnati Christian University, 52-year-old Robert Williams, has been arrested and accused of soliciting sex in open air. Only in Ohio. Soliciting sex in open air. He was arrested with two other men on Saturday. It was a gay sex sting operation. The police said he was China. 2,700-year-old stash of reefer? Oh, my God. The chief financial officer of Cincinnati Christian University said to have manually stimulated an undercover police officer in Mount Airy Forest. He is charged with sexual imposition. Sex in open air? Soliciting sex? There's a law against that in Ohio? Soliciting sex in open air? The Cincinnati Christian University has placed Mr. Williams on administrative leave while officials, quote, assess the facts of the case. A spokesperson. Well, this can't be real. The Cincinnati Christian University president, whose name is David Faust. This is 2,700-year-old reefer? Oh, my God. The university president, David Faust, said in a statement, quote, "We are shocked and dismayed by the news of Robert Williams' arrest. It's a personal tragedy for him and his family, and we lift them up in our prayers." Soliciting sex in open air. That's a new one to me. I've never heard of that one. I guess that's opposed to soliciting it in a closed room or closed air. I don't know. What else we got here? Oh, yeah, I love this one. This is from Parrish, Florida, which I believe is it's Manatee County, I think. Authorities say a man who lives with his parents there has been charged with attacking his father with a Christmas tree and its metal stand. According to the sheriff's report, 37-year-old Thomas Edward Lackey was arrested and charged with felony assault. Authorities said he threw the three-foot Christmas tree at his father, but missed. They say he then tried to use its steel base to strike him. Mom and dad subdued Thomas and called the authorities. What else we got? That's probably enough, wouldn't it? 2,700-year-old reefer found in a tomb in China. And they ran all kinds of tests on it. And they found that it was very high in THC content. 789 grams. You got the time. I don't have the time right now, but you can make, how many jokes can you make out of that story? Huh?
For example, did they cut it with melamine? There's one.
New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson has been named to head the Commerce Department in President Barack Obama's administration. That was announced today at a news conference in Chicago. Richardson has been around for a while. He was Secretary of Energy and U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. during Clinton's administration. Nearly two decades as a congressman representing New Mexico. And he was governor of New Mexico, elected in 2002, and reelected 4 years later. So Governor Bill Richardson. Now, regarding Governor Bill Richardson, our economic affairs correspondent has some things to say about that we'll share with you when we come back from this break. 2,700-year-old reefer. Cultivated for psychoactive purposes. Oh, man. If he looks space, that would you buy his story? Would you believe he had an eye infection? And yeah, God looks baked. Yeah, God smells. We'll be right back.
soothing bedtime lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour, in answer to a surprising number of inquiries, yes, there were seeds available in that 789-gram stash of 2,700-year-old cannabis found in a tomb in China by a bunch of archaeologists, I guess. Now, regarding Bill Richardson's appointment today, I know a lot of you cynics out there, you really terrible, terrible former Democrats who are just beside yourselves with grief because Barack Obama is appointing what appear to be a bunch of, you know, retreads. I don't know why you've lost the faith. Oh, stop. Come on, we've declared a moratorium. What he meant by change was, you know, away from the psychopathic policies of George W. Bush and the neocons in the Bush crime family. That's what he meant. And as proof of that, look at his appointment for Secretary of Defense. Now, there's someone to... Oh, wait a minute. That's right. Well, you got to have faith. And if you don't have faith, what have you got, brother? If you don't have faith, sister, you don't have anything. So have faith. The man isn't even sworn in yet. Quit your bitching. Prairie 2 writes, Mike, contrary to popular belief, Bill Richardson was not given the less important job in favor of Hillary, who got Secretary of State. He has real-world experience as a diplomat sitting across the table from pistol-waving dictators. This will come in handy. Because it's the Commerce Department that will be in charge of negotiations to redo our trade and monetary relationships. The Bretton Woods Agreement that deals with currencies and banking will need to be reworked literally within days of taking office. The General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, the World Trade Organization, and the NAFTA agreements need to be replaced with something sane if we are to have our country back. Hillary can be in charge of bringing peace to the Middle East. That should keep her busy. But the real negotiations that will determine whether or not our civilization continues in a form we can recognize will be handled by the Commerce Department, even if the State Department takes credit for it. Richardson will need to face down people who have been making trillions from the status quo and are far more scary than any pistol waver. And just in case the saving civilization thing doesn't work out, I'm learning how to make stone spear points, because the canned goods won't last forever. Oh, Lord have mercy. A dozen retired generals and admirals. This from our military affairs correspondent. She reports that a dozen retired generals and admirals have met with President-elect Barack Obama's transition team today to plead for a clean, unequivocal break with the Bush administration's interrogation, detention, and rendition policies. A dozen retired generals and admirals. The meeting saw these military flag rank military officers arrive armed with a list of what Marine General retired Joseph Hoar called things that need to be done and undone. Major General Hoar was chief of the U.S. Central Command from 1991 to 1994. General Hoar said the list was extensive. Tops on the list is the CIA's authority granted by the White House to use harsh interrogation methods that go beyond those approved for use by the military, including torture. Torture. Bush vetoed legislation championed by these retired officers back in March that would have held the CIA to the military's interrogation methods. The generals and admirals argue that having two U.S. detainee treatment standards endangers American military personnel who may one day be captured because it denies the U.S. government the moral authority to demand that our soldiers be treated in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. Yeah, we can't demand that anymore, can we? The group, which represents more than 36 military officers with nearly 80 stars between them, is also pushing for an end to extraordinary rendition. That's the transfer of prisoners to other governments who torture far more seriously than waterboarding. They also want the closing of Guantanamo, the jail at Guantanamo Bay. That's something Obama's already announced he plans to do. And these admirals and generals believe Obama's election, and a stark contrast between his policies and Bush's, may reverse the decline in world opinion about the United States. And much of that decline, the admirals and generals say, is tied to Guantanamo detainee abuse. Vice Admiral Lee Gunn, a former Navy Inspector General, said, quote, gradualism won't do. It's time for an absolute change. That abrupt change will send a signal to the world that America is back. And we'll be back right after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Hey, truth seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, more of Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour here, regarding that story about the Chinese marijuana, 789 grams found, 2,700-year-old reefer, carbon dated, still high THC content, and found in a tomb in China. Next to a Caucasian who is obviously preparing for the afterlife. I say obviously, that's according to the archaeologists who discovered this. But Prairie 2 says, well, that explains it. That explains why the Chinese invented paper. Oh, you just got that, Kathy? It took you a while, didn't it? And Bridget writes regarding the Chinese find, Mike, well, duh, every single historical culture has had a relationship with naturally occurring psychoactive substances, whether marijuana, mushrooms, morning glories, some types of sage, coca leaf, the list is very long. The earth supplies us with many, many natural ways to alter consciousness. One can only assume that there's some value to the process because nature tends not to produce anything that doesn't have a purpose. Shamans have used various psychoactive substances since, well, always. Our culture is the first one that I know of to criminalize the altering of consciousness for any purpose, except, of course, via distilled spirits brewed by companies who make money for Cindy McCain and pharmaceuticals sold at exorbitant prices by companies that lobby to keep the natural free stuff off the market. The drug laws in this country and in much of the rest of the world are totally insane. I'm not talking about poison like meth, but to criminalize plants that grow naturally in my meadow is nuts. Yeah, there's certain nuts you can get high on too, right? Signed, Bridget. Oh, last night I had a kind of a smarmy comment about former Senator Bob Graham of Florida. He is the co-chair, along with a Republican whose name completely slips my mind, of this report that the Washington Post wrote about the other day that says the United States is headed for a major terrorist attack, probably biochemical attack, sometime before the end of 2013, and very... very frightening report. And, of course, the cynicism, at least my own cynicism, that has developed over the years because of the candy-colored coded terrorist attack things, code red, cold, blue, cold, purple, cold, yellow, and all this madness. And then to have someone like Laura Bush say that her husband has kept us safe when her husband was responsible for the most murderous terrorist attack on U.S. soil since not against Native Americans, of course. That I always have to qualify that. Not against the slaves we brought here, but against people in, let's put it this way, in modern times. How's that? And I made some kind of a couple of cracks about Bob Grand. Well, I got an email from Edie in Dogpatch, Alabama, who writes, Mike, regarding last night's program, and I'm just as dubious about official commissions as you are, not to mention the blank, blank. Oh, good, Edie, that's a good one. Not to mention the blank, blank corporate media. That said, I have a lot of respect for Senator Bob Graham, former governor of Florida, candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination and cancer survivor. When Graham was still in the Senate, he was one of the Democrats who came out of that briefing on Iraq, and unlike Biden, Clinton, Rockefeller, Dodd, and Edwards, to name a few, told the truth without breaking whatever blood oath they had taken. He said something to the effect that he had not seen anything to make him think that Iraq was a threat to anyone. And then the corporate media went to work on him, making the man a joke by constantly referring to his daily journal. The minutiae of that diary was fodder for everyone, from Chris Matthews to Jay Leno. Graham finally retired and witnessed the carnage that continues to this day. So, Edie writes, I remember Senator Bob Graham fondly. I can still see his ashen face. The few words he could say after that meeting spoke volumes to me. Edie, Dogpatch. Yeah, you're right, and I sometimes put my mouth in, open my mouth before my brain's in gear. I don't think Bob Graham is a bad guy at all. There was a death yesterday of everyone knew her who knew her as Odetta. The singer whose voice wove together the strongest songs of American folk music and the civil rights movement. She was 77. The cause was heart disease. She had a career of almost 60 years. She sang at coffee houses in Carnegie Hall. She became one of the best-known folk music artists of the 50s and 60s, for those of you of a certain age. And her recordings of blues and ballads influenced people like Dylan and Joan Baez and Janis Joplin. And Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her seat to a white man, led to a boycott of segregated buses in Montgomery, Alabama. She was once asked which songs meant the most to her, and she said, all of the songs Odetta sings.
I was over in Arkansas, the people did ask me what you call me.
She told the New York Times about her songs. They were liberation songs. You're walking down life's road. Society's foot is on your throat. Every which way you turn, you can't get from under that foot. And you reach a fork in the road, and you can either lie down and die or insist upon your life. Her fame hit a peak in 1963 when she marched with Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and performed for President John F. Kennedy. But with the assassination of King in 68, much of the wind went out of the sails of the civil rights movement. And the songs of protest and resistance that had been the movement's soundtrack began to fade. And Odetta's flame and her fame flagged for years thereafter. But in 1999, President Bill Clinton awarded her the National Endowment for the Arts Medal of the Arts and Humanities. And she told a friend that she was hoping to sing at Barack Obama's inauguration.
Then
Odetta Holmes was born in Birmingham, Alabama on December 31st, 1930, and died yesterday in New York.
It was down in Louisiana, just a mile from a Texarkana, in them old cotton fields at a
home. Coming up, in about 45 minutes, we'll have a moment with Bob that we haven't had for a while. For those of you who are a moment with Bob fans. And I do believe that this evening, because of a sore throat and travel plans for tomorrow, we're going to rebroadcast the first hour during the third hour of this program. So we'll have 2 hours live and 1 hour of rebroadcast on the Malloy Show tonight. Barack Obama today turned from national security to domestic concerns. Yesterday he attended the National Governors Association, the National Governors Association in Philly. He told the country's governors that his administration would not delay in pushing an economic recovery plan that is designed to bring some relief to the states. Georgia is on. We're right on the verge. I think the city of Atlanta is just about on the verge of financial collapse. But 41 of the states are forecasting budget shortfalls this year and next. Now that's real serious for state government. States are prohibited by the Constitution from working with red ink. They can't do deficit spending. The federal government can, but the states are prevented. Denied the ability to do that. And state revenue only comes from taxes and fees. That's about it, right? Can you think of anything else? Taxes and fees, that's it. And in order to meet some of these, the necessary balancing of books, so many states are cutting out programs like meals for children who can't afford to bring their lunch to school, mental health programs, daycare centers for people with Alzheimer's, you know, stuff like that.
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. So Barack Obama addressing the National Governors Association, National Governors Association Conference in Philadelphia yesterday, said he understands the terrible situation the state governments are in right now regarding financing, regarding revenue. And a lot of that comes from his work as a senator, representative senator in the Illinois, as a senator in the Illinois State Senate. Another one of those things that they tried to attack him on during the campaign, right? He was a community organizer. And that was supposed to be a negative. So he and his crew organized 50 different states into the model so often put out there by people who understand organizing. And now, the need of state governments in order to continue functioning. I think Obama certainly understands that better than, John McCain. John McCain spent a part of his career blowing up schools and hospitals and different entities that could produce revenue for the state. He spent a lot of time blowing them up and murdering the people inside, whereas Barack Obama hasn't done that yet. And as far as the plan, they're batting around. You know, I think $700 billion must be the number du jour or du week or du year or something. $700 billion. Now is here's that number again. This is what the estimate is regarding the price tag for helping 41 states bail out of the mess that George Bush has and the Republicans has put everyone in. I frankly think that any state that voted Republican, voted for McCain or has a Republican governor or both, shouldn't be given a goddamn dime. Nothing. You don't get anything. Get out on the street corner and sell pencils. Go pull yourself up by your bootstraps. We don't want to hear any whining. Remember, Barack Obama's a socialist. You certainly don't want any of this filthy, rotten socialist money. So the Barack Obama administration ain't going to give you any. How's that, huh? You little whiny-ass Republicans. How about that? Wouldn't that be kind of poetic? I like that. I like that. Almost as much as the 2,700-year-old Chinese reaver. So, but being the sort of administration that Barack Obama says he's going to run, you know, cross-cultural, cross-party differences, cross-everything. The states that voted for John McCain and the hoe from Wasilla, they will get their share of whatever money is appropriated, which is a shame to me. It really is. I think those states ought to be cut loose from the union, and at least where it concerns the redistribution of tax money. Remember that? Remember that? Remember Palin and McCain and that half-ass from Toledo, Ohio, Joe the Dork? Getting out there every day, talk about, well, redistribution of money. No, redistribution of wealth. Jesus Christ, that's communism. Well, okay. Let's see if you can put your mouth where your ass is, so to speak. Barack Obama is suggesting a $700 billion bailout for all the states that need the money, including those that are populated by people like Joe the Dork and the hoe from Wasilla and all you freaky people who voted for John McCain because McCain was convincing you that you didn't want none of that redistribution of wealth. Screw that! I want to stay unemployed. I want to stay on the street because they're going to repossess my house. I don't want any of your damn commie money. Okay. Then I would imagine the states that are run by Republican governors and that voted red, you know, Republican, will refuse any of this money. Right? Huh? Am I right or wrong? Where's Joe the Dork? Hey, Joe! What do you think of this redistribution of wealth thing that Brock's talking about, huh? Oh, damn commie. Right? Gosh, and that was only a couple of months ago, wasn't it? Joe the Dork. Did he get his country music recording contract, Kathy? Do you know? Huh? You don't think so? What about the hoe from Wasilla? Did she get hers? In a manner of speaking.
I think she's still slaughtering turkeys.
Still slaughtering turkeys? She was here in the great state of Georgia.
Where there's lots of stuff to kill.
There is. There's an awful lot of stuff to kill. California may run out of money again this year to supplement school meals, in part because more struggling families are taking part in the free school lunch programs, the reduced price school lunch programs. That's according to California State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Jack O'Connell said in a statement, quote, without quick action by the governor and the legislature, districts will be forced to make a series of unacceptable choices to dip further into their own bare bones budgets, serve less nutritious foods, and not comply with California's nationally renowned nutrition standards if they don't get some money. The federal government, you see, provides $2.17. That's the low number, to $2.57. That's the high number for each free or reduced price meal in California in the schools. California provides an additional 22 cents. And last school year, the state of California ran out of money in May. It's likely to run out earlier this year, O'Connell said. He's requesting $31 million to prevent that. School lunch programs. But this pig bastard in the White House had his wars, didn't he? Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour on the Malloy program here on Nova M Radio. Coming up in about 25 minutes, we will have another moment with Bob, so stick around with that. The heads of the car companies have presented their or submitted their proposals to Congress for the loans they need to survive, Chrysler, Ford, and GM. They've asked for a combined total of $34 billion. Jesus, a couple of weeks ago it was $25 billion. They get sent home to work out a plan, and it goes up $9 billion. Oh, well, you know, a billion here, a billion there. Eventually, you're talking about real money. But what they're going to do is slash costs, reduce levels of debt, invest in greener technologies, cut their workforce, and the chief executives of Ford and GM have even offered to work for a dollar a year if Congress approves the emergency aid. A dollar a year. Wow. Oh, that is so symbolic, isn't it? We're going to work for a dollar a year. We are. My goodness, guys, that is just incredible. Now, this comes in the face of, did you see these reports on how much sales have plummeted? Ford is down 31% over a year ago. GM down 41%. Chrysler down 47%. Oh, but hold on a second. Hold on a second. U.S. sales for Honda is down 32%. U.S. sales for Toyota is down 34%. You see, it's the problem here is a little bit bigger just than just how the car companies have so royally screwed up. But that's a whole different story, right? So General Motors is asking for a loan of $12 billion with an additional $6 billion if necessary to help it survive. Ford requests $9 billion, which it hopes it won't need, but they would like that, you know, put over there and where they can get to it real quick. Chrysler wants $7 billion to survive. If you add all that up, it's only, let's see, what is it, $12 billion, $21 billion, and so $28 billion. So where's the other $6 billion? Jesus, they can't even do this right, can they? Anyway, oh, here it is. Oh, yes. No, this isn't it. Never mind. General Motors also said it would continue its efforts to develop more fuel-efficient vehicles. Its efforts.
But we don't know what to do. We're going to continue our efforts. But what do we do? Who do we turn to? How do we make more fuel-efficient vehicles? We had this problem back in the 70s, and we told you then it couldn't be done. It would have taken a $14 part, added the catalytic converter. Our cost would have been $14, but we couldn't do it. Or was it $34? I don't know, but we couldn't do it. Well, we're going to continue. We're still trying.
The automakers also say they will reduce their workforce considerably by 2012. Ford also said it would sell its five corporate jets as part of its cost-cutting plan. Ooh, that'll really make a difference, won't it? Let's get rid of them jets. Give them to Sarah Palin. She can sell them on eBay. Huh? Ford also says they are going to get rid of their Volvo business. You know, they own the Swedish car maker Volvo. So the plan is on the table there, I guess. Now, the Swedes say, wait a minute. The Swedish government has, you see, because the government in Sweden is involved in everything, the Swedish government has ruled out taking over Volvo if Ford is unable to sell it. So, you know, that may be another brand that just disappears. The Bush crime family has already expressed skepticism about the bailout proposals. They say they'll probably veto the whole idea if it's presented to them. Of course, Bush is a psychopath, a sociopath, and the Bush crime family wants to see these automakers fail because it will then destroy the unions. The UAW, the United Auto Workers, is reportedly considering renegotiating their members' contracts. But then there's this, you see, unions are to blame for the big three automakers' problems, according to a television ad meant to stoke public opposition to organized labor's number one legislative priority, and that is the Employee Free Choice Act. We mentioned this the other night. Unions would be allowed to come into the workplace and just hand out cards. And if you want to be a union member, you check a box, give it back to the guy who handed it to you. They count them. If the majority says, we want to be a union comes in. Oh, no, 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 no. A Chamber of Commerce-backed gang of roaches called the Employee Freedom Action Committee. The Employee Freedom Action Committee. Whew. Has a television ad that asked the question, steel, auto, airlines, what do these industries all have in common? Hundreds of thousands of lost jobs and union bosses that helped put them out of business. Wow, really? The ad has been running on CNN and Fox. A similar ad ran in Mississippi and New Hampshire in conjunction with Senate races in those states, where business groups are working like field hands to defeat the Employee Free Choice Act. Employee Free Choice Act! No, 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 no. We give you freedom. We're the Employee Freedom Action Committee. Don't listen to the Employee Free Choice Act. No, it's slavery. Richard Berman, this group's executive director, is putting this garbage on the air, says, if Americans like what the unions did to Detroit's economy, they'll love what the unions will do to the country. You know, see, it's somebody like that that I'd like to just get into a fist fight with, you know. I'd like to just beat his ass. I really would. I really would. Because that kind of garbage, who's going to dispute that? Which one of these candy asses on television, Charlie Gibson, is going to sit this freak down and say, wait a second, that's a lie. It's a goddamn lie, and you know it's a lie. There are many reasons why the automakers are going broke. One of the reasons is they have to provide health insurance to 250,000 retired workers. Shouldn't that be someone else's responsibility? Say, oh, I don't know. Let me think for a minute. Ooh, I know. Nationalize health care, like most civilized countries have. But no, this little twit, Richard Berman, says, it's the unions. Unions did it. Bergman went on to say, quote, the unions have played a significant role in nearly bankrupting the big three automakers with untenable inefficiencies, which have put tens of thousands out of work. You see, end quote. You see, this is how you know this guy is a real dork, because the efficiency of the American worker has gone up. It goes up constantly because the American worker is squeezed. Be more efficient or you're on the street.
Oh, okay, okay.
But this this little creep-ass Richard Berman, whatever the hell his name is, he calls unionized auto workers inefficient. Alan Reuther, who's the legislative director for the UAW, said Bergen's comments are, I can't say what Reuther said, but it has a bunch of anatomical parts of the body put in different places in his comments. But Reuther said the auto industry's problems rest on a series of bad trade and health care policies, and that the credit crunch is to blame for the current crisis. Oh, no, no, it's the unions. Reuther went on to say that major concessions offered by unions in their contract in 2007 and 2005 will result in the elimination of the cost gap between union and non-union plants. In other words, the unions have bargained themselves right down to the level of non-unionized workers. And yet this Richard Bergman creep, who you know you just like to bloody his nose, you know it as well as I do. Ah, the unions did this. You know, Ronald Reagan warned us about the unions all those years ago, didn't he? Wouldn't you like to just punch his lights out, huh? You wouldn't? I would. Past the hour. This would be a nice lead into a moment with Bob after the break here at the bottom of the hour. This is, are you aware that 5 years after World War II ended, a group of scholars published a landmark analysis under the title The Authoritarian Personality? They wanted to know how a progressive nation like Germany could have been taken over by something as barbarous as the Nazi Party. And it was obvious to these researchers that a small group of psychopaths could not have subverted established institutions unless their propaganda resonated deeply with a large sector of the German population. You know, you can't just stand up on a street corner and start screaming about we're about to be invaded by aliens unless there is something in the innermost unconscious or not so unconscious of your audience that says, oh, yeah, that's right. I've been seeing the starships at night, you know, that sort of thing. So they wanted to know how the Germans could be taken over. According to the research, people who favor authoritarian policy or politics and succumb to reactionary rhetoric exhibit a consistent personality pattern of, quote, anti-democratic tendencies and fascist potential, end quote. In other words, they tend to share common psychological characteristics, including some or all of the following. Listen to this list. An entrenched obsession with safety, security, and order. Rigidly absolutist black and white thinking, you know, like us against them. An overemphasis on strength, power, and control. A might makes right orientation. Authoritarian submission, a willingness to blindly obey the rules of authorities. Authoritarian aggression, an aggressive attitude toward individuals or groups disliked by the authorities. Bullying individuals or groups perceived to threaten traditional values, like immigrants, Muslims, gay folk. A belief that negotiations, understanding, empathy, and compromise are signs of weakness. A belief in the need to punish those who do not follow rules to the letter. Scornful. Now, what this list is, this is how a country becomes Nazified. The people have to be willing to partake in the blood orgy. A belief in the need to punish those who don't follow the rules to the letter. Scornful rejection of the subjective, the imaginative, and the aesthetic dimensions of life. Oh no, none of that. Cliche mongering, superstition, stereotyping, fatalism. A belief in fixed, unalterable, and traditional roles for women. Secret insecurity when unable to live up to high standards imposed publicly on others. Yeah, well, you know, you tax cheat, and then the guy cheats himself, right? Identification with those in power, with excessive emphasis on posturing toughness. Destructiveness, cynicism, general hostility, and a habit of putting down perceived opponents. Projection, the tendency to see evil, exploitativeness, and danger in others instead of in oneself. An exaggerated concern with other people's sexual activity. The authors also found a very high correlation between possessing a number of these traits and demonstrating a consistent and malignant prejudice against so-called outgroups. Wow. Now, from that list... How many of those characteristics fairly easily dovetail with some of the prevailing attitudes in this country that put Bush close enough to the presidency in 2000 that he could steal it, and close enough to the presidency in 2004 that he could steal it once again? Pretty incredible. A belief that negotiation, understanding, empathy, and compromise are weak. Weak. When those are absolute examples of strength. But try explaining that to a Republican. Right? We'll be back after the break. Stick around. Moment with Bob coming up next. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. The country's headed for recession, reminiscent of the Great Depression. Our lives worth the world of power, easy question. Planes hit the towers in the Pentagon, killing those the government wasn't dependent on. It's easy to control the scare, so they keep us in fear. With their favorite Middle Eastern demon named Bin Laden this year. Bush disguises blood, lust is patriotism, convincing the living to love operations. Let's get them. But when he realized we don't support their attacks, they needed something to distract, anthrax. Let's further demonize his Afghanis, so Americans cheer while we kill their innocent families. And what better place to start a war? To build a pipeline to get the oil that they have wanted before. It's about 25 before the hour. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it is time once again. recognize that music. Time once again for A Moment with Bob. Tonight's moment is titled The Fog. Hey, Mike, between election night and inauguration day, we live in another dimension, a dimension of muffled sound, a dimension of blurred sight, a dimension of confused mind. We're living in a land of both shadow and substance, of unseen things and ill-expressed ideas. We've crossed over into the Twilight Zone. And if we're getting our news from the television, to paraphrase Rod Serling again, it is difficult to sift through mainstream media news when every few minutes we're interrupted by 12 dancing rabbits singing about toilet paper. Since election night, I've been stumbling around in a dense fog, a greasy mist that briefly parts so I can glimpse historical markers that show us what's happening but don't show us a way out. Last week, 4 service members in Iraq and Afghanistan were killed. 134 Iraqis were removed from this earth, as well as 174 people slaughtered in Mumbai. Then the fog closes in again. We walk a little farther ahead and see, from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, this. The next meltdown, commercial property. Black Friday's retail shoppers hunting for holiday bargains won't be enough to stave off what's likely to become the next economic crisis. Malls from Michigan to Georgia are entering foreclosure. Commercial victims of the same events poisoning the housing market. Hotels in Tucson, Arizona and Hilton Head, South Carolina also are about to default on their mortgages. The number of late payments and defaults will double, if not triple, by the end of next year, according to analysts from Fitch Ratings Limited, which evaluates companies' credit. Scott Tross, a real estate lawyer with Herrick Feinstein in New Jersey, said, quote, we're probably the first inning of the commercial mortgage problem, end quote. Companies have survived plenty of downturns, but economists see this one playing out like never before because many banks no longer hold the loans they made. Over the past decade, banks have increasingly bundled mortgages and sold them to investors. Pension funds, insurance companies, and hedge funds bought the seemingly safe securities and are now bracing for losses that could ripple through the financial system. Paul Miller, an analyst with Friedman Billings Ramsey, who was among the first to sound the alarm bells in the residential market, said, quote, it's a toxic drug and nobody knows how bad it's going to be, end quote. Unlike home mortgages, businesses don't pay their loans over 30 years. Commercial mortgages are usually written for 5, 7, or 10 years, with big payments due at the end. About $20 billion will be due next year, covering property ranging from office and condo complexes to hotels and malls. Those retailers typically were paying rent that was expected to cover mortgage payments. When those $20 billion in mortgages come due next year, and 2010 and 2011 totals are projected to be even higher, many property owners won't have the money! End quote! The dead and bad debt keep piling up around us, but we can't see anything clearly because of this damn fog. Our ship of state is not only rudderless, but the captain and his crew have gone missing. Of course, I'm mixing my metaphors here because I don't know for sure if we're steaming around in circles in the Sargasso Sea or wandering near the haunted forest. As soon as we see a sign that says, I'd turn back if I were you, I guess we'll know for sure. But which way is back? We're here. Wherever here is, because the Bush regime slapped down their last trump card, regardless of what they put on the table in the past. They've never played the complete lack of leadership card so well. All the chips are being raked in as the foundations crumble. Talk about timing. The Bush regime's policies have worked perfectly for them. Each one designed to enrich themselves at the expense of a couple of gutted countries. They are only failures if you're not reaping the benefits of disaster capitalism. And now when we see their policies exposed for what they are, it's not that the emperor has no clothes. The emperor is not even there. But I can't write about the Bush regime anymore. Enumerating their crimes is a futile exercise reminiscent of punding. Punding? Never heard of punding? Me neither, until I ran into a burnt-out clutch of speed freaks years ago. Then I had to look it up. Punding is human activity characterized by compulsive fascination with and performance of repetitive mechanical tasks, such as assembling and disassembling, collecting or sorting household objects. For example, punding may consist of activities such as collecting pebbles and lining them up as perfectly as possible, disassembling doorknobs and putting them back together again, trying but failing to systematically remove the entire contents of all the drawers and shelves in the home and sort through all their contents. People engaging in punding find immersion in such activities comforting, even when it serves no purpose, and generally find it very frustrating to be diverted from them. Dopamine overactivity results in punding. It is commonly associated with side effects of drugs used against Parkinson's disease and with the use of methamphetamine, in which context it is known as tweaking, which increases dopamine release and blocks its uptake. But I am no longer interested in the repetitive mechanical tasks of collecting, sorting through, and writing about the crimes of the Bush regime. The evidence is in. And unless the impeached Bush community wants to go the way of the Flat Earth Society, it's time for them to finally drop the impeachment crusade and start talking about prosecution. Elizabeth de la Vega's United States versus George W. Bush et al. Was published in November 2006. And Vince Bugliosi's The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder came out last May. Hint. After Inauguration Day, George W. Bush is going to have Secret Service protection for the rest of his life instead of the prison guard he deserves, unless we do something about it. The perpetrators may abscond to Dubai or Paraguay before we even know it. But it's hard to be heard in this fog. Sounds don't carry. The words are muffled. And most of us are just waiting. 47 days to go. Along the way, Christmas and New Year's, diversions and distractions while we're waiting for the new guy and his team to take over. So many of us saw in the new guy what we wanted to see. 47 days from now, the fog might clear and we'll begin to see who he really is. In the meantime, there are rumblings from the left and screechings from the right as we make our way through the fog. And we've always got to remember, monsters and ghosts shamble on in the murk along with us. The Republican base can still bite. Even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright. 33 days since Halloween and counting. Regards, Bob. Another episode of A Moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Stay tuned. You never know when A Moment with Bob will, well, pop up again. All right, where are we? I'll tell you what, we don't have too many minutes of program left. Let's do a few phone calls. We'll have a live program tomorrow night from San Francisco, and then Friday night when we have the Kick 'em and Stomp 'em gig in, I don't know, they've rented some massive venue in San Francisco. And I'm not sure what... do you know what the format is, Kathy? Are we just going to have a Republican burning up on the stage? Have we got someone? We're going to tie this person to the stake, douse them with Iraqi oil and set them on fire? No? That's not it? So Friday night, there will be no program from the... there will be. It'll be one of these so-called best ofs. No, usually our associate producer, Ian, picks a good one. So that'll be Friday night. Tomorrow night, just a regular program. Do we have anyone who would like... Okay, we'll try to get a couple of calls in here. We have a break coming up very quickly. So What is this? Giving up on God? Oh, never mind. That's for some other program. I don't think we'll do that one tonight because we are more geared up for something other than giving up on God. I am still fascinated by the 2,700-year-old pot discovery story somewhere in China. That to me is just pretty astonishing. All right, the number here is 800-989-1480. If you would like to get a quick comment in tonight, now's the time to get in the queue. 800-989-1480.
For the IRS or no bureaucracy. They steal my cash and kick my ass and tell me that I'm free. I wonder, is there anywhere that the people let you be? If Tommy Payne woke up today, King George is all he'd see. And bush it, their flags are all unfurled. Tons and tons of bush it, the fleas have wagged the world. Kings may come and kings may go, but King George still remains. Just say no to bush it if they haven't cooked your brains.
Before the hour, thanks to Ian Huff, who engineered the program tonight, Ben Birch, our technical advisor, Sharon Gordy, Bruce Enberg, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, all of whom contribute to this program. Our executive producer is Catherine Bay. All right, Lorna is calling from Santa Monica, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, Lorna.
Howdy.
Hi.
You know, we had the Chevy Volt. And people loved it, the electric car.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, why don't we make them pull that out and start producing it right away instead of, you know, why do they have to tool up? I mean, they've already made it. It's already tested.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I have just a weird feeling about this whole bailout thing and the sincerity of the people upon whom now we have to rely where it concerns, well, are they really going to do it this time? Are they really going to act responsibly? Are they going to stop convincing Americans that we want to drive garbage? You know, so I don't know.
Yeah, why can't we put that in the deal? But they don't, you know, it's like, there's an attempt by the Illuminati, as far as I'm concerned, to just break the United States for their end. To bring one world government in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, a one world government though might not be a bad idea, Lorna. When you really start to, I mean, stop and think about it, if we had one world government, there wouldn't be any wars, would there? We would all be dedicated to making sure that there was a global standard of living that did not involve competition for resources because we would all share the resources, right? We think of the trillions of dollars that would be saved because there'd be no more use for not just so-called defense spending, but also the weapons industry. We could all work together to stop global warming instead of blowing smoke up each other's anal orifices. Just think of all, you know, one world government sounds mighty damn good to me all of a sudden. Ha! We could have parliaments that were elected from the various continents. And the parliaments would meet 1 year on the European continent, the next year on the North American continent, the next year on the South American continent, the next year on the Asian continent, the next year, you know, rotate it like that. And then we would have true global universal health care. We could lower taxes because all of a sudden everybody would be paying just kind of the same little dribby drabby amount if you have 7 billion people kicking into the same kitty. Wow. Just think, no more dictators. Lorna, this is a great idea. No more fascism. No more capitalism. Just kind of global democratic socialism. And everybody could go to nice resort areas and have vacations. And you say this is a plan by the Illuminati. I need to get their phone number. Kathy, can you get somebody from the Illuminati on the program?
I'm on it.
Okay. RB is calling from the Great White North, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, RB.
How you doing, Mike? How are you?
I'm just fine. Are you folks finally getting rid of Harper?
We're going to try. Yeah, we're looks like we're going to decide to get rid of him because...
He's mightily. Well, he was just elected. What, 6 weeks ago?
Yeah, but he's a dickhead because he won a minority.
Yeah,
started acting like he was George Bush and he was going to start pushing all these plans through, and the liberals and the NDP and the Bloc Québécois got together and said, "Up yours, buddy. This is not the United States of America, and we're going to get
That's good. Maybe the rest of the world will take notice that
they have more than two parties and things happen, you know. Get actual things done.
Yeah, that's true. But that's not why you really called.
No, I really called about this guy named Hamid Karkari, a very you don't know much about him. A police officer in Mumbai,
right.
Was the head of the India's anti-terror squad, was one of the unfortunate victims of last week's Mumbai attack in India there.
Uh-huh.
Did you know that he was in the middle of unraveling a false flag attack on September 29th? He was sent to investigate a blast that occurred. Let's see, I have it written down here. Malagon, in a place called Malagon, India, there was a bombing that was initially blamed on Muslims, you know, to try to whip up war fever in India against Pakistan.
Right.
And he started investigating it and found a strange connection to a Indian Army officer named Lieutenant Colonel Shrikant Purohit, who was linked to the blasts and then was caught red-handed trying to cover up his tracks. As soon as he brought that to the attention of the newspapers and was going to indict this lieutenant colonel,
right,
this Mumbai attack occurred, and he happened to be one of the victims. Isn't coincidence a lovely thing to fall back on?
I sometimes feel like somebody walking through the forest, and I keep finding little bits of string attached to bushes and stuck on the bark of trees, and there's no path to follow, but I keep finding these little bits of string, and I think to myself as I collect the string, wow, somebody came through here and left a trail. I just wish that the wind and the elements had not destroyed the trail, and that the string was all in one long piece so I could get out of here. And then all of a sudden, the woods fill up with the fog.
Yes, and what's funny is that there's a British company, the Prince Andrew. He put a Prince Andrew and a bunch of these British royals put on a weapons manufacturing
display. Hey, RB, I'll tell you what. I would love to read more about this. Email me a link about this guy. All right? This sounds very interesting. I'd like to see this. All right, Truth Seekers. I'll be back tomorrow live from San Francisco, and then Friday, you're excused. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy Program on Nova M Radio. We're going to open up the phone lines now if you'd like to comment. We welcome your call. The number here is 800-989-1480. During the break, I wish I had clarity or purity of thought, but I have neither. I could no more think straight than, you could. A couple of emails during the break. Phyllis in Wisconsin says she came in late and hadn't heard the part about General Barry McCaffrey's corporate links, but read the same article I did in the Times. Yeah, we covered that, Phyllis. But Phyllis writes, maybe these people know full well that we'll get our asses kicked in Afghanistan. But they also know that they will become mighty rich while our country is bled dry. So, Phyllis in Wisconsin. So, I mean, you know, ever since Smedley Butler wrote War is a Racket back in 1905, 1910, 1903, I don't know. Double Medal of Honor winner, General Smedley Butler. Ever since he wrote about War as a Racket, I mean, do any of us really believe that our battles have been for mom and apple pie and the flag and our Judeo-Christian heritage and justice and truth? And come on. If there was a tangential issue of fighting for justice and truth in some of our wars, oh, okay, so be it. But if you think about, and you might even consider World War II, but if you think about all the wars subsequent to that one, and the one immediately preceding that one, they would have nothing to do with patriotism, had nothing to do with mom and the flag and apple pie and white picket fences and little puppy dogs, and everything to do with death and destruction for corporate powers or royal families or something. So it is not weird to consider what the New York Times writer had in Sunday's paper and last April about the tons of money being made, not just by these retired generals who act as consultants, but also by the whole war industry. But you know all this. You know this. There's no point really in talking about it. It's just like I say, it's maddening sometimes. And Prairie 2 suggests that he's not too concerned about having the type who are willing to do so-called wet work in the clandestine world, you know, murder. He's not too concerned about that because if you go on the assumption that they do their work out of patriotism and not some Republican agenda, then maybe Barack Obama wants these people to give him advice, to assist in his transition team. But, of course, if that's the case, why did this guy cut and run? The one who said, oops, wait, never mind. So I'm being very, you know, even more confused than I usually am. Again, I wish I had clarity of thought or purity of thought or anything remotely resembling either one. But I'm just kind of wandering around stumbling into stuff. General James Jones, Jim Jones. Oh, can't be his. Well, it is. It certainly is. As far as the economy is concerned, we'll try that tomorrow night. All right, if you'd like to talk, the number is 800-989-1480. Devron is calling from Seattle, listening on the Internet. Devron, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Long time no talk.
Welcome back.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Much obliged. What was I going to say? Yeah, I remember Jim, man, I tell you, I just got back from the medicinal store out here. Got me some good broccoli.
Oh, yeah? Well, good.
Yeah. Jim Jones, you said that sending in more brigades, but Gates, I don't know how you feel about him, but isn't he quoted saying that no matter how much we send, that, you know, Afghanistan wouldn't be stable? I mean, I love the, you know, he gave the tally. I was only aware of the Russians being unable to do anything there. But, I mean, just given the terrain and the region, how mm-hmm. could anybody do anything? The best we could do is go and build some schools and some hospitals and bring in some technology and win these people over. And that's how you defeat, quote-unquote, terrorism.
Well, you know, my attitude about Afghanistan is my attitude about so much of the world. Why do we think our way is better to begin with? I understand that their treatment of women in that part of the world, based on their religious beliefs, is sick. But I'm against all religions. So, you know, why invade Afghanistan? Why not invade Colorado City?
Does it matter to you, Mike, who the Bible was written by? Because my father's always told me it was written by Jews. I don't have nothing against Jews, and I'm not trying to hate on them, but I'm trying to figure out, isn't it just a handbook? Why does he have so much hatred? Why do you guys have so much hatred for these religions? Isn't it the people and how they use it? I mean, these books, they're just books.
No, they're much more than books. They are rigid. I mean, you can't say they're just books when you have a whole branch of Christianity that believes in the inerrancy of the Bible. In other words, every word in the Bible is from God, every comma, every everything. That takes it beyond the realm of book and into a manifesto or live this way or we will kill you. Thanks, Devron. I appreciate you checking in. As far as Afghanistan is concerned, there's some hellish practices by our standards that occur there, but I guess by human standards. And Devron's suggestion is one I certainly agree with. If you want to overcome ignorance, okay, there's ways to do it if you got the patience, if you're willing to spend 40, 50, 60 years, and nobody's going to make any money. War is a racket. War makes everybody rich except the people who have to die. But everybody else gets rich except the people who have to die. And the families of the people have to die. They don't get rich. But everybody else gets rich from war. So war is a moneymaker. Peace is a loss leader. Peace? That costs money. But if we're really interested in peace, in improving the lives of Afghans, if that's what we're about, I don't know why. How about improving the lives of millions of people in this country who don't have health insurance and no job and are facing foreclosure? Why don't we improve the well-being of our folks before we go into a region that has been defeating Westerners for 2,000 years and decide to wage war? That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? That makes great sense. Oh, well, Mike, come on, Jesus Christ, these people came and bombed us. No, they didn't. Those were Saudis who came and bombed us. And an Egyptian, and a Moroccan, and an Algerian. But last time I heard, there wasn't a single Afghan or Iraqi among the 19. If we want to extract revenge, let's head for Jeddah, Mecca, Medina. Whoops, can't do that. So, as far as the question about increasing our presence in Afghanistan, it will prolong the death and destruction, increase the numbers of dead and brain smashed and legless and armless coming back to the United States. It will prolong the misery for the Afghan people. It will do exactly what Alexander the Great and the British leadership and the Russians finally decided wasn't worth the time. And we pull out.
ready for Radical Talk Radio? Make mine Mike Malloy on Nova M.
It is 21 past the hour. Email here from Ron, who apparently is still lost in Pennsylvania. A note on the moratorium. He writes, Mike, I know you said no gnashing of teeth, no kvetching, no left-hand comments about the president-elect, but as the so-called change rant on your mini-blog seems to indicate today, have we been taken for a ride again? If so, what's there to say? What could anyone possibly say, snide or otherwise, that could speak to the level of insult and deflation of hope that would occur if Obama proves to be yet another Republican-light Pentagon puppet? What a body blow that would be. I can feel myself bracing for a kick in the crotch. I'll tell you, Mike, this hawkish BS is a recurrent nightmare. I hope you're right about the Obama purview in these most recent selections for his national security team. We'll see, I guess. Otherwise, oh great mystery, help us. Yeah. We'll see. I'm still going to, although my position is starting to weaken radically, but I'm still going to hold to the idea that there is a method to what appears to be madness out here in our world, which apparently is not the same as the world inside, wherever all these people are inside. You know? All right, back to your phone calls. Marge is calling from Indiana. Marge, welcome to the program.
Well, good evening, my friend.
Hey.
I'm still trying to figure out what they're going to do with Bill. Is he going to become the ambassador of Smooge?
He's probably going to wind up being appointed senator from New York. They won't have to change any of the letterheads. It'll still say
there you go.
Senator
yeah.
Clinton. Yeah,
yeah there's that, of course, whatever. I wonder how long it's going to take him to stick his foot in his mouth. Because he's never been one to be shy about what he has to say or where
no,
he has
no,
to
no,
say.
No, he hasn't. But apparently he signed like an 89-page contract about what he will and will not do with his wife's ascension to Secretary of State. Didn't you read that thing in the paper where he's going to reveal something like, I don't know.
All the people that contributed to his foundation?
Yeah, huge number, 150,000 names or something. And
holy crap.
He's not going to take any speaking fees unless it's vetted by the Barack Obama administration. He's not, you know, all the stuff that he's agreed to do. You know, this Clinton melodrama is really working on my nerves. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't know where it's going.
Unbelievable.
Did you watch the Q&A today?
No, I saw no television today.
Oh, well, there was one, I don't know who it was. I thought it said the new New York Times, but I may be wrong. The reporter asked the question having to do with something that was an exchange between Obama and Hillary during the campaign, you know, trying to elicit some little And Obama just looked at him, and he said, he answered the question, he says, but of course, he says, you're wanting to have fun with it. And I thought, damn. He came right back and, you know, challenged the man,
right.
You know, instead of trying to spin it or do a dance
right.
about, you know, well, this is whatever, and we're all adults and all, whatever kind of crap they choose to come up with. He
right.
says, you're just trying to have fun with it. And I thought, well, imagine that.
Well, let's hope that he continues to do that.
Oh, you know, and then something about, well, that's all you're going to get from me today. He wasn't going to tell him any more than he planned to tell him today. You know, and the thing,
right.
the
right.
situations as they evolve, you know, more would be become available. And something about we only have one president at a time. And I thought, yeah, well, anyway. But there's something else I wanted to bring up.
Okay.
It's sort of politics, and it's not. It has to do with broadcasting. I've sort of become a fan of a show called Boston Legal. And if you know anybody that happens to tape the show, get a copy of tonight, because I know it was on opposite you. And anybody on the West Coast that still has a chance to watch it tonight.
Oh, yeah?
There was, I don't know exactly the particulars involved with the fight between a producer, David E. Kelly, and ABC, but something happened. And how the hell he got this scripts that he's gotten past the network for the last couple of weeks, I don't know.
Hmm.
Tonight, it had to do with an aging person in the person of Betty White, who may or may not be a little bit goofy, you know, because of reaching age, wanted to sue somebody. And she, you know, brings out this big, long, it looked like a computer sheet that, you know, that, a roll that,
yeah.
you know, and goes on. And he was, and John Larroquette was trying to say, well, you can't, you don't have a standing. And then finally she, you know, she got to the point, she said, the networks. And his eyes kind of lit up, and I thought, uh-oh. She, you know, that the networks don't put anything on that is intelligent. Mm. That, they're, you know, people over 50 is the largest growing population demographic in the country. They've got more extra money to spend on things.
Right.
But people don't, you know, even consider their wants or needs or whatever. And they just, you know, skew everything to the teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And all this other crap. And some of the lines on the show tonight were absolutely fantastic.
Well, I will do everything that I possibly can, Marge, to track that down and catch the I'm sure they'll have a rebroadcast. We'll be right back.
Don't go to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you on Nova M Radio.
It's about 25 before the hour, but before you go to bed, it's time for Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Once again, gather round, kiddies. Uncle Mike has a scary one for you tonight. Are you ready? It was written by Matthew Alexander, except, well, that's not his real name. I should have felt triumphant when I returned from Iraq in August 2006. Instead, I was worried and exhausted. My team of interrogators had successfully hunted down one of the most notorious mass murderers of our generation, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the mastermind of the campaign of suicide bombings that had helped plunge Iraq into civil war. But instead of celebrating our success, my mind was consumed with the unfinished business of our mission, fixing the deeply flawed, ineffective, and un-American way the U.S. military conducts interrogations in Iraq. I'm still alarmed about that today. I'm not some ivory tower type. I served 14 years in the U.S. Air Force, began my career as a special operations flying pilot, flying helicopter, saw combat in Bosnia and Kosovo, became an Air Force counterintelligence agent, then volunteered to go to work to Iraq to work as a senior interrogator. What I saw in Iraq still rattles me, both because it betrays our traditions and because it just doesn't work. Violence was at its peak during my five-month tour in Iraq. In February 2006, a month before I arrived, Zarqawi's forces blew up the gold-domed Askariya Mosque in Samarra, a shrine revered by Iraq's majority Shiites, and unleashed a wave of sectarian bloodshed. Reprisal killings became a daily occurrence, and suicide bombings were as common as car accidents. It felt as if the whole country was being blown to bits. Amid the chaos, four other Air Force criminal investigators and I joined an elite team of interrogators attempting to locate Zarqawi. What I soon discovered about our methods astonished me. The Army was still conducting interrogations according to the Guantanamo Bay model. Interrogators were nominally using the methods outlined in the U.S. Army Field Manual, the Interrogator's Bible, but they were pushing in every way possible to bend the rules and often break them. I don't have to belabor the point. Dozens of newspaper articles and books have been written about the misconduct that resulted. Those interrogations were based on fear and control. They resulted in torture and abuse. I refused to participate in such practices, and a month later extended that prohibition to the team of interrogators I was assigned to lead. I taught the members of my unit a new methodology, one based on building rapport with suspects, showing cultural understanding, and using good old-fashioned brain power to tease out information. I personally conducted more than 300 interrogations, and I supervised more than 1,000. The methods my team used are not classified. They're listed in the unclassified field manual, but the way we used them was, I like to think, unique. We got to know our enemies, we learned to negotiate with them, and we adapted criminal investigative techniques to our work, something that the field manual permits under the concept of ruses and trickery. It worked. Our efforts started a chain of successes that ultimately led to Zarqawi. Over the course of this renaissance in interrogation tactics, our attitudes changed. We no longer saw our prisoners as the stereotypical al-Qaeda evildoers we had been repeatedly briefed to expect. We saw them as Sunni Iraqis, often family men protecting themselves from Shiite militias and trying to ensure that their fellow Sunnis would still have some access to wealth and power in the new Iraq. Most surprisingly, they turned out to despise al-Qaeda in Iraq as much as they despised us. But Zarqawi and his thugs were willing to provide them with arms and money. I pointed this out to General George Casey, the former top U.S. commander in Iraq, when he visited my prison in the summer of 2006. He did not respond. Perhaps he should have. It turns out that my team was right to think that many disgruntled Sunnis could be peeled away from Zarqawi. A year later, General David Petraeus helped boost the so-called Anbar Awakening, in which tens of thousands of Sunnis turned against al-Qaeda in Iraq and signed up with U.S. forces, cutting violence in the country dramatically. Our new interrogation methods led to one of the war's biggest breakthroughs. We convinced one of Zarqawi's associates to give up the al-Qaeda in Iraq leader's location. On June 8, 2006, U.S. warplanes dropped two 500-pound bombs on a house where Zarqawi was meeting with other insurgent leaders. But Zarqawi's death wasn't enough to convince the Joint Special Operations Task Force, for which I worked, to change its attitude toward interrogations. The old methods continued. I came home from Iraq feeling as if my mission was far from accomplished. Soon after my return, the public learned that another part of our government, the CIA, had repeatedly used waterboarding to try to get information out of detainees. I know the counter-argument well, that we need the rough stuff for the truly hard cases, such as battle-hardened core leaders of al-Qaeda, not just run-of-the-mill Iraqi insurgents. But that's not always true. We turned several hard cases, including some foreign fighters, by using our new techniques. A few of them never abandoned the jihadist cause, but still gave up critical information. One actually told me, quote, "I thought you would torture me, and when you didn't, I decided that everything I was told about Americans was wrong. That's why I decided to cooperate," end quote. Torture and abuse are against my moral fabric. The cliche still bears repeating. Such outrages are inconsistent with American principles. And then there's the pragmatic side. Torture and abuse cost American lives. I learned in Iraq that the number one reason foreign fighters flocked there to fight were the abuses carried out at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Our policy of torture was directly and swiftly recruiting fighters for al-Qaeda in Iraq. The large majority of suicide bombings in Iraq are still carried out by these foreigners. They are also involved in most of the attacks on U.S. and coalition forces in Iraq. It's no exaggeration to say that at least half of our losses and casualties in that country have come at the hands of foreigners who joined the fray because of our program of detainee abuse. The number of U.S. soldiers who have died because of our torture policy will never be definitively known, but it is fair to say that it's close to the number of lives lost on September 11, 2001. How anyone can say that torture keeps Americans safe is beyond me, unless you don't count American soldiers as Americans. After my return from Iraq, I began to write about my experiences because I felt obliged, as a military officer, not only to point out the broken wheel, but try to fix it. When I submitted the manuscript of my book about my Iraq experiences to the Defense Department for standard review to ensure that it did not contain classified information, I got a nasty shock. Pentagon officials delayed the review past the first printing date and then redacted an extraordinary amount of unclassified material, including passages copied verbatim from the Army's unclassified field manual on interrogations and material vibrantly displayed on the Army's own website. I sued, first to get the review completed and later to appeal the redactions. Apparently, some members of the military command are not only unconvinced by the arguments against torture, they don't even want the public to hear them. My experiences have landed me in the middle of another war, one even more important than the Iraq conflict. The war after the war is a fight about who we are as Americans. Murderers like Zarqawi can kill us, but they can't force us to change who we are. We can only do that to ourselves. One day, when my grandkids sit on my knee and ask me about the war, I'll say to them, "Which one?" Americans, including officers like myself, must fight to protect our values, not only from Al-Qaeda, but also from those within our own country who would erode them. Other interrogators are also speaking out, including some former members of the military, the FBI and the CIA, who met last summer to condemn torture and have spoken before Congress at considerable personal risk. We're told that our only options are to persist in carrying out torture or to face another terrorist attack. But there truly is a better way to carry out interrogations and a way to get out of this false choice between torture and terror. I'm actually quite optimistic these days, in no small measure because President-elect Barack Obama has promised to outlaw the practice of torture throughout our government. But until we renounce the sorts of abuses that have stained our national honor, Al-Qaeda will be winning. Zarqawi is dead, but he has still forced us to show the world that we do not adhere to the principles we say we cherish. We're better than that. We're smarter, too. Another edition of Uncle Mike's Story Corner, brought to you by your friends at Torturers Are Us. Matthew Alexander, by the way, is a pseudonym. He led an interrogation team assigned to a special ops task force in Iraq in 2006. And he's the author of How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Use Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. And his piece appeared as an op-ed piece of the Washington Post yesterday. The part that most got my attention was the part that that says the number of U.S. soldiers who have died because of our torture policy will never be definitively known, but it's fair to say that it's close to the number of lives lost on September 11, 2001. If George W. Bush and his gang of murderers is not pursued and brought to justice, then it's probably time for all of us to just kind of be quiet and go about our business. Program's almost over. Time just rips by when you're having fun, doesn't it? It's about 10 before the hour. Thanks to our crew. Program was engineered by Ian Huff, who also answered your calls. Our podcast manager and technical advisor is Ben Birch. Our military affairs correspondent is Sharon Gordy. This program's ethical advisors are Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf. Bruce Enberg is our economic advisor and the executive producer. Is Catherine Bay. I will be here Tuesday night and Wednesday night and Thursday night broadcasting from Green 960 in San Francisco. That'll be fun. And Friday night is the gig in San Francisco sponsored by our affiliate there, Green 960. I hope you have a ticket. I understand they're sold out. And I'm not sure what we're going to do Friday night, but it should be raucous fun. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, I look forward to meeting you if you happen to get one of the tickets. If you didn't get one, call the station and demand to be let in anyway. Want to do that? Back to your phone calls. Michael is calling from the Bronx, listening on the internet. Michael?
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Okay. First off, I look forward to hopefully you come to visit New York City in the future.
Well, I don't know. We're not carried by a station there, Michael. So it'd be nice if that were to happen. But
right. I understand.
Oh, good.
But I suppose you were talking about or heard about the Walmart tragedy.
Well, I heard about it, but I can't talk about stuff like that because it just. I don't know. It's just way too bizarre.
It was way too bizarre and something right. That was totally unnecessary.
I feel very bad for the victim.
It's so close to the holidays, too.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, the whole story, the guy that got trampled at the Walmart on one of the Walmarts in Long Island is what Michael's talking about. I'm sure everybody's familiar with the story at this point.
Now, I think I have a solution to all this.
And you do? What would it be?
Yeah. They need to remodelize their entranceways. Instead of the doors, the kind of doors that they have, why don't they have what I would call terminal doors?
Wait. I have a better idea. Why not cut the crap? Why not stop turning the so-called Christmas holidays into nothing but an orgy of materialism and craziness? You know, the retailers who do this should be hanged. The media who promote this frenzy should join them on the hanging tree. This is Michael. This is it's obscenity.
Yeah, I understand
the whole thing.
I understand what you're
screw remaking the doors.
My thing is about safety. It doesn't just have to be about Black Friday. It could be any particular event.
Only right. Well, I understand what you're saying, Michael. I really do. And as a solution that buys completely into the insanity, it's probably a good one. But we don't want to buy into the insanity. You know, I heard something today that they're going to have to move the birth of Jesus into the spring so it doesn't conflict with the Christmas holidays. You want me to repeat that? No, never mind. But the whole thing is madness to me. It's just insanity. I can't, in the first place, I can't imagine standing in the darkness at 4, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning in order to go buy something. Well, I mean, come on. You know, I don't care if they're selling SUVs for $50. My ass is not going to be there. It's crazy. And then the fact that, you know, Walmart does this. What is opening up at 5 a.m.? Walmart is the only retailer that ever shows a profit, right? What's the matter? Boys, is your profit falling? You're not going to make $50 billion this year. You're only going to make $48 billion. So let's do this. And let's hire a temp worker. The guy that was trampled had no idea what was about to happen. Walmart didn't brief him. Now listen, when we open the doors, you're going to see a crush of humanity smashing and yelling and ripping and stinking its way into our store in order to grab stuff. So be careful. No, the story I get, they didn't tell him. They didn't brief him. This is crazy. Any Christmas shopping, we don't do Christmas shopping, do we? Do we, Kathy? We don't do it anymore. We get some stuff for my grandchildren and our daughter, maybe a gift or two. We buy it from the internet. My adult children, gift card. Here you go. Here's $200. Have fun. I would no more participate in this garbage than I don't know, chop off my left hand. I watch this stuff on Atlanta television on Friday after Thanksgiving. News helicopters flying over the endless supply of malls in Atlanta, Georgia. reporting, well, this parking lot is 85% capacity. This one's 92. Well, if you're going to go down Interstate 75, you want to go over here to Interstate 85. Blah, 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 blah. Complete gutter sickness, madness. And the right-wing talk show pundits are insisting that this be called the Christmas holidays. You like that? Don't get me started, Michael. Don't get me started. It's too late in the program. As a matter of fact, it's time to pack it in and... Right? I'll see you tomorrow night, Truth Seeker. Take care. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Molloy. This is Nova M Radio.